Let us get started now.
Okay, so last week, I want to go over a couple of things just briefly, add some examples that I had from my own personal week, just to sort of flesh out some of the ideas. Last week, the three things that we pretty much I wanted to focus on was eliminating the word no from our vocabulary, learning other ways to basically say no when the answer is no. That was one part, and then working on praise, how to correctly and effectively praise. And then the last one was recognizing the feelings and emotions of your child where they are, as opposed to just always denying, and even when they say whatever they say, we sort of right away deny their abilities and their feelings to express themselves. So I just sort of wanted to start with some examples as you just to go into work through that and through some real life examples, just as sort of the things that that took place. So starting with praise. So we mentioned the idea is really to describe what it is that's going on. So we had an incident with our Shlomo Akiva, our delicious 4-year-old. So at the end of the bath time, he likes to play. So the routine, of course, is I come in with a towel. Would you like me to help you get into your towel and into your pajamas, or do you want to do it yourself? If he chooses, I'll do it myself. No problem. Your time. I'm out of there. So he, for those who know him, he's not the most deliberate, delicious little chub. Takes his time. About 30 minutes later, he makes his way back into the kitchen, fully clothed in his pajamas. I mean, Intad has got the whole thing. He's got it on the right way, even the works. So how do you respond? I'm trying to express how wonderful a job this is. So the so I said, Mommy, look at this. Shlomo Akiva got out of the bath all by himself. He toweled himself off all by himself. He pulled out his pajamas all by himself. He put on his underwear all by himself. Now, as this is going on, I'm literally going through every single step that he did, ignoring the fact that it took a half hour, just going through what it is that he did, and you could see on his face, he's already now trying to read, like, what's going to be next. He took out his pants, and he's like, and put it on all by himself. He took out his shirt and he put it on all by himself. And you see, like here it is, an accurate description of, I'm not saying anything other than what he did, and you could read on his face that this is a form of praise that's working. This is doing the job in terms of procedure, like look at what I did. Not saying anything out of control, just accurately describing what took place. 2 days later, Shabbos, our 7-year-old who's got a new tie. He's so excited. He's got a real tie. None of these clip on. Probably in the kitchen. Are you listening? So, when you get a new tie, you have to learn how to make a new tie. That's part of the big boy aspect of having a new tie. So I showed him how to make the tie. We did the simplest knot that I know how to make, and you gotta make it. So he takes a lot of practice. So I see him in shul for the first time. He comes in whatever time he walks in, and he's got a tie that's perfect. Literally, the knot's perfect, the length is perfect. I say, baby, look at your tie. So he says something along the lines of, yeah, but it took me 45 minutes to do. Right? Now, how do we, as a parent, respond? Now, if that's true, that's what it's, how do we pray? Okay, well, but you did it. So what are these words that have to be the tips of our tongue when your child is actually taking something which is an accomplishment and turning it into a big downer? Like, yeah, but, you know, this was horrible. It took me 45 minutes. So I said, look at that tie. You got the front and the back. It's perfect. It lines up just like that. And the knot is exactly right. And it looks perfect. And you put it, you're straight. Just describing everything about it. And then acknowledge, this fits right into the other part, about he's feeling sort of pretty pathetic. Because look, it took 45 minutes. And acknowledge that. I know it's frustrating it took 45 minutes, but today it took 45 minutes. Next Shabbos, I bet it'll take 30, and the Shabbos after then, it'll probably take 15, and the Shabbos after that, you'll probably have it in a snap, right, like that. So describe the perfect aspects of what it is that you see, acknowledge that right now, you know, he's not feeling so great about it, and then turn that into something, okay, that's how it goes, but we're going to then, you know, this is a place to build, and look how great it is that you accomplished that, what it is that you accomplished, and we're going to move forward. Let me give one more example, and then just, I'm just curious if you had any experience with this yourself over the week. So the other thing was acknowledging your children's feelings, where they're at. So I had, Sunday night, it must have Shabbos, one of the two nights was bedtime for Shlomo. So I went through the routine, 5 minutes, he's playing in the playroom with Legos or something. 5 minutes of bedtime, 3 minutes of bedtime, 1 minute, bedtime. Everything is there except it doesn't work because he recoils in that scene that you're all familiar with. No, you know, as soon as you say bedtime, and he starts right away just screaming, no, 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 screaming back. So, okay, a couple options here. So in our, without any parenting seminars, we just pick the kid up and have a yelling and screaming match the whole way to his room, which is the whole night's going to be a disaster. That's one option. So we're not going to go there. So love and logic would take what approach if we were going to love and logic this moment right now?
No bedtime book.
Something along those lines. We're already, part of that was we're already past that. This is like a Sunday night, most of the shows, like there's no routine, it's already... We could try that, but I really, the bottom line, I didn't know what I was going to do because I didn't have anything handy, and I was already exhausted. I wasn't really sure. You could try to, I was going
to
try that. So
tomorrow night, we're not going to be able to play because obviously it takes you too long.
Something like that. Right? That would be the a general approach. So we could go that way, so I figured right now this week we're working on the other approach of just sort of acknowledging where he's at. So I said, okay, let's try it. How would I reflect what he's going through? So I said, oh, don't worry, you could finish it tomorrow. Helpful or unhelpful?
Very
helpful. So that didn't help at all. I thought right away, scratch that one. That's equivalent to telling a person who just lost a huge business deal and they're all upset about it. Don't worry, there'll be one next year. Like that's the equivalent, like for a child, like tomorrow, like that's an eternity. The unhelpful, so I forget. So I said, oh, you're so upset you really wanted more time to play. Do you know what he responded to? He said, yeah, I only have two more pieces to put on my house. So I said, oh, you can put on two more pieces. Done. Picks himself up and walks to his room. And I'm like, wow, that worked. And what would have been literally a screaming match, or even if it would have been a level logic, it would have been a much more drawn out, figure something out and then have to deal with the consequence, come up with the consequence, start all that mental energy of what's going to work. Well, I have a screaming child. I went through the whole process. Usually that works when it's 5 minutes and 3 minutes and he's recoiling in total, like, I don't want to go. Gosh, it looks like he really wanted to play more. And yeah, I'm almost done. That was easy enough. You can finish that off. Finish it off and that was the end of the story. So that's really why I like these two approaches together. There are times with the brushing of the teeth and other examples where love and logic is just the best. And it just takes off all that pressure of having... And then there are times where there are other ways to sort of respond, sort of get in, where is your child? Both in the sense that I brought up with a tie, like when your child's coming with something which they're clearly down about it, recognize that. Get in their world, what it is that's upsetting to them about that took you so long to make a tie. That's okay, that's frustrating. Next week will be better. But acknowledge that and praise them for what they did in an accurate way. There are these, they work. There's, that two things. So curious, quickly, I don't want to take up too much time, but this second approach that we've been working on, this Faber Maslow, which is recognizing their feelings, appreciating them, approaching them, where they are. Any feedback at all? Was it worth trying? Did it, any attempts made? Was it helpful, unhelpful?
There was an observation that I made when I was doing it and witnessed Marcy doing it. And that is that it felt so fake and put on. It really feels over the top, like over analytical and over, you know, touchy-feely, warm, fuzzy, you know, stuff that I haven't really been brought up with and not into that at all.
Yeah.
We were always just, you know, black and white.
Right.
We were at my in-laws this weekend, and I tried doing it, and my in-laws were basically like,
it feels very fake. I mean, it does. But I wonder if there's, you know, maybe we're doing it too far.
That's certainly possible. There's a time and a place for it. In the book, if you have a chance to read it, I highly recommend, you know, it's this one, the How to Talk.
Right.
The way that they write the book as if it's a seminar, that the workshop that they're doing, and many of their first responses you'll read, the parents come back with that. They say, this was real fake. And they say, and that's true because you've never done that before. It's not a way that you're really acknowledging. And you'll find your comfort zone that, you know what, you're not always going to want to respond that way, but sometimes it's important to get into that. We'll do a little bit more today, even also something you really need to, yeah.
But Jordan responded positively to it. He had made me a bracelet. And so he brought me the bracelet, and instead of just saying, oh, how beautiful, I love it, thank you, I said, wow, look at this, there's seashells on there, and you took time to do this. And he's like, yeah, and look, there's a bead hiding inside. And he was excited about that. I was, like, looking at it and noticing it. And I have the three of them sitting on the sideline, just like...
That's all that matters. And I challenge you, the next time Darren brings you home something, to either say, I really love it, and put it away, or really describe the efforts that you went through. Let's see whether or not he's vomiting then.
We've been doing that because we've been teasing each other with that kind of stuff this week.
It does feel unnatural.
It is, and it is, because it's new. What does unnatural mean? Unnatural is something that's not normal to your nature, so it is unnatural, and I would certainly expect that if your son is reacting well to it, you'll see the benefits. And the example that I just brought from Shlomo with the Legos, we avoided a huge fight simply because he was able to say to me, I had two more pieces, in a way that was non-confrontational. I don't know that I would have gotten it out of him otherwise. And that's so common, where a four-year-old is able to express it. As they get older, it only gets, they're more reserved from sharing those things with us. So the more that we allow them and give them the safety place where they can, there will be benefits. I agree with you that it's going to be unnatural, and you'll find your safety, your comfort level.
But then there was also times when it was very natural. Like today, we had a fish die. So it was...
Oh, that was an example with the cartoon. How did it go?
And he was hysterical. And we're like, it's an algae eater. Like, and we're like, let's go flush it down the toilet. You know? And he's like, oh.
Devastated.
He's like, a whale? It's going to go to the ocean and a whale's going to eat it?
No, that's not what happened. He said he started crying, and then Marcia said, why don't you want to flush it to the toilet? Because we explained to him that it goes to fishy heaven, it goes out a little out to the ocean or whatever. And then he said, yeah, but if it go out to the ocean, a whale's going to eat it. So it's interesting because these things came out that we wouldn't have addressed it 3 weeks ago. We would have just said, you know,
get you a new one, goodbye.
Right.
But then we talked about it, and I was like, sweetie, this happens sometimes. You know, and all this stuff. I said, I know you're really sad. And he was like, yeah. I said, why are you sad? He said, because I like the fish. You know, and he talked it through. And then he decided that he wanted, you know, I said, should we go get, would it make you feel better if we went and got another one? Yeah, so we went and got new fish today. And he's totally over it. He's forgotten about the fish. But, like, that moment, I let him cry and tell me that he was bummed about it.
Except that sounds exactly like the cartoon we read.
It was. Yeah.
Excellent. Great. I feel totally successful. Worth it all. Let us go home. Okay, so I photocopied another series from the book. These are straight out of the book. I said I did a little headings.
I also found that it's cool. You've made it in a very positive light. I found that one of the students, sometimes the kid will draw the picture and you're like, wow, that's great.
Right.
Instead of, I see you made two circles and, I found this helpful about setting up.
Excellent. It is.
That's going to be awesome for my intro.
Yeah. I was going to say, and you found you got positive.
The kids felt like you were, instead of saying, oh, wow, you made it, they just felt like, oh, she's really paying attention to what I did. And they were more expressive about the things that they were doing in the classroom.
It is wonderful. I had a two-year-old in the house once. We had shop company, so I can't even remember at this point at all who they were. There was a two-year-old who came to the table to show. I was sitting with the father, and they were with crayons in the dining room, and brought us a picture. And the father said something like, that's amazing. It was a scribble scrabble. And I looked at it, and I said, wow, I see red and orange and blue and yellow. And so the kid runs back and comes back and had added something else. Like I said, oh, I see a new blue line. Kid ran back and it literally went on for 5 minutes where the child was going back and forth and adding things just because somebody was engaged in noticing the way that they were doing it, as opposed to what would otherwise would have been just, nice picture and then the sort. So it is it's a fantastic tool. It might be a little unnatural, but it's worthwhile. Okay, so there are three topics tonight, which Mr. Shem will try to get through all of them. Engaging cooperation. So again, this is going to be another approach. This is a non-love and logic. This is going to be a little bit uneasy for some of you, but it really is pretty straightforward. It really is. And these are great tools. These are all going to sound... Do you have... I have enough. They're so simple, you're going to think of it like, why did I need... Like, I knew all this, or I should use all this, but what's helpful in my mind, and what I've experienced personally, is I know that this is like a tool. It feels better when you do something and you actually feel it's part of a structure. Like this is, I'm not doing it haphazard. There are a bunch of tools that we'll go through as far as this concept. So let's look at this first page describing the problem. This is phenomenal. I'll bring some examples from today. So generally, if you have a little child at the bathtub, right? You're always so irresponsible. You start the tub and you forget. What's the best option is simply describe the problem. Johnny, the water in the bathtub is getting close to the top. Don't threaten the child. Don't lecture the child. Simply describe what the problem is, and then the child is able to figure that out. So this is what's on my mind today. So I get home. I literally was preparing this in shul this morning. I came home at noonish, whenever it was. Rifki's on the phone with her brother or something, and I'm in charge of lunch. Kelly has a friend. Everyone's got noodles and cheese. A bunch of plates are on the table. I'm already tired. I haven't eaten lunch, and now the table is just full of empty bowls, and everybody scatters off. So I'm thinking, all right, so now they need to clean off the table themselves. So what are my options in front of me as a parent on a tired Monday holiday weekend afternoon, and I got six bowls on the table, and I'm just looking for a place myself to eat. So if I'm love and lodging it, what's my response?
I'm so sorry, I won't have energy to
I'm not doing anything now. I can't do anything now. Because this is why, how do you look right now? If I have to sort of wait for them to want ice cream, which they did, of course, within 20 minutes, and then it would have been something along the lines of, and I can't give ice cream, right, because there are no clean bowls, or because there's no room on the table, or because I can't give out another bowl. If this is what the table looks like now, imagine if I, something along those lines, and then they'll all learn. That's one option. And again, I just wasn't in the mood for that today. So, but I was just holding this, because this is just what I was preparing with, like 40 minutes before. So I walked into the playroom, and I said, Macheli, I still see empty bowls on the kitchen table. And I just walked back into the kitchen. And she and her friend, they're both nine, they picked themselves up, walked into the kitchen, took their bowl, and no one said a word. No confrontation, there was no demeaning, there was no demand. It was just simply, the bowls are still on the table. So now I have Shlomo and his bowl still on the table, and he's four. So I think, well, that worked really well with a nine-year-old. But I wonder if that would work with a four-year-old. So I walked in, he's sitting with a toy, and I said, Shlomo, your bowl is still on the table. I walked back into the kitchen, and literally a second later, there he marches right in, takes his bowl from the room, and goes back into the playroom. This is great stuff. And it's true. It very often, now the concept describing, there's nothing better. The kids walk in and there's backpacks in the, or shoes in the hallway. There's backpack. There's clothing left in the bathroom. There's stuff left. And it's simply a matter of, just like we are trying to take the word no out of our vocabulary, we're trying to take the demands and the requirements and the requests, because it's a constant barrage with children. That's all they hear from us. Do this. Don't do that. It's very, they just tune us out. Just like we tune out people who talk to us that way. So simply just learn to describe the problem. Get into the habit. It's great for praise. It's great for asking the things. Just simply describe what it is that you see and needs to be fixed. That's tool number one. It is one of the most effective things. You look at the top of the page two there. Two more examples. Right? The light's on the bathroom. You don't need to say, how many times do I tell you? The light's on in the bathroom. Or the one that I like the best is the bottom one of that, in which you need to make a phone call. Simply state, here you have a problem. Child's on the phone. This will happen if you don't yet have children who are on the phone. If you have girls, they will be there soon. Well, here we have a problem. I need the phone. My daughter's on the phone. She's in the middle of what is a very important conversation for her, but you also need it for what's in your world far more important. And this will play itself out. So you have two solutions. You either get a second line, and then you get a third line, or you learn to communicate in ways that so simply describe, I need to make a phone call now. Give the child a chance to respond. Give the child a chance. If that doesn't work, if these description things don't work, that's when, again, this is, I'm always like plugging the dual models of the love and logic versus like Faber Maslach, like learning how to speak. So if when you communicate in a non-threatening way and it doesn't work, so then you need to come and then you need, okay, well then there's going to have to be some kind of consequence, but at least this is a first approach that just is a way to say I need something done, simply describing what that problem is. Number two, tool number two, give information. Look at the difference between like the bottle of milk left out. Right? Who drank milk and left the bottle? Right, those are questions. I love the best part about the cartoons is they describe all the horrible ways to communicate. Don't put your children in that situation. I remember hearing on a tape someone from some rub, I don't remember who it was, saying, the worst thing that we do is we teach our children to lie. We ask questions. Now, any normal, healthy child that isn't equipped, and we as adults are barely equipped to do this, when we are posed with a question directly that we've done something wrong, and we have to admit to it. Imagine you made a $40,000 mistake for your boss. And he comes straight out to you and says, are you the one who did this? So most of us, our knee-jerk reaction would be, no, it was him. I mean, that's a natural, normal, that's a huge thing, and he's coming to me and he's asking, did you do this? That's it. So for a child, did you leave the milk? It's the same level on a child's world in which they're being accused by their parents, especially if you know the answer to the question. You know it wasn't you. You know it was a child. Don't ask questions that teach our children to lie. Because you're just opening up the door, at which point they're going to lie, and now you're going to get into a battle of, yes, you did. Oh, I did. Yes, you don't lie to me. Unhealthy. Unproductive. Don't go there. If you know the answer to something, don't ask the question. State something. I don't like, so in this example, kid, milk turns sour when it's left out. Let me give you information. Does every 4-year-old know that milk is going to go sour when it's left out? You know, maybe if you went through that once with them before, but not necessarily. So maybe they need information. And even if they do know it, that would be a great example of, you know, you can either say that's describing a problem. If the child knows it already, the milk's been left out or the ice cream has been left out. Now, ice cream, again, this is your classic level, this is your distinction, right? You come into the kitchen, you're given your 4 or 5, 6-year-old permission to get some ice cream, and they left the ice cream out. So love and logic rules would say, no problem, I'm leaving it out, and then I'm going to have to throw it out, and then tomorrow, no more ice cream. You can go that route, that's totally fine, if the ice cream is for them and not for you. Right? If it's for you, you don't want to do that. Why do I have to suffer? Why do the other kids have to suffer? So that might be a fine approach if you have just one kid who's eating ice cream age or who will notice a difference, and then you simply want to say, we're going to the store, let's say it's on a Monday, we'll be going shopping again on Thursday, we'll have more ice cream with it. You can take that approach. That child will learn, you leave the ice cream out, there's no more ice cream. Very natural consequence, you did nothing. Let's say that's not an option because there are other kids. So you need another way to get the child to put the ice cream back, but you don't want to go around, you know, put the ice cream. So either describe the problem or simply give them an ice cream will melt if it's been left out. Just getting into the habit of this method of speaking is a, for many of us, if this is like, duh, I've been doing this my whole life, great. For many of us, it doesn't come out naturally. It really, it's a new way to learn how to communicate just to get into the habit of this is what I'm doing. I'm just going to be describing, giving information. The top of page 3 is the classic one that is a standard in my house. This is not for writing. No, paper is not for writing for. Teeth are not for biting. Simply just giving information about you want to use cell phones are not for children to play with. Computers are not, you know, balls are not for bouncing in the house. It's just a way of, when there's not, just describe, or in this case, giving information, this is not for this activity. Crayons are not for drawing on the walls. In whatever, just as an example as far as that goes, and you could take a look at the full examples. I want to make sure that we get through them, so let's move on. Tool number 3, say it with the word. This is, again, just to remember, the cartoons always are cute. You have here the mother trying to get her kids into pajamas, so you can give a long lecture. You can explain why it's necessary for the kids to get into pajamas, and how many times you've asked me to get into pajamas, and how annoyed you are doing it. Or you simply just say, you know, pajamas. This is a great tool. Children who are getting used to, especially if you have, you know, you're using on your own comfort level a love and logic consequence thing, you don't need to do more than that. Time to brush teeth. Teeth brushing time. Dinner. Pajamas. Don't get into long discourses. It's unnecessary. Just get in there. It's totally fine. I could simply say it in a word. And then let everything else happen from there. Then you have the other 2 examples as far as, you know, your lunch. I feel like a broken record, but here you have the lunch example is, again, just the dual love and logic versus, you know, love and logic, the child walks out of the house without their lunch, is, right, that pure love and logic, a purist would simply say, no problem, they're not eating lunch today, and then I'm going to feel really bad when they come home, I'm so sorry, I feel so bad, I wish I could have done something, what are we going to do about it? That would be that whole approach. And if you're not so harsh, is there, like, there are certain examples where, again, with the baseball glove, my kid walks out the door without the baseball glove, so that's great. That would be a perfect example where I go through the whole routine, very empathic, I feel horrible, I feel sorry, can you bring me, I wish I could, I'm so busy now, next time. But for lunch, where I don't want my child to go without lunch, but I don't want to nag him, and I don't want to yell at them, and how do I... So these are the tools. Lunch is still on the table. There's a way to speak in which you don't threaten, you don't use those words which demean the child. We're trying to use our words in a protective manner. And that example where a child has forgotten a lunch, I have seen, or I should say, heard with my own ears, the way that parents will say, get that information across to their child, leaves the child feeling absolutely pathetic because they've forgotten their lunch. There's a way to talk in which you have totally just demeaned and humiliated the child because they forgot the lunch. Leave it all up. Just say it with the word. Okay, this is the next one. Tool number four. Talk about your feelings. This is very, very important. The first one is the most important one that I really want to talk about. So the first example is you have a child tugging on their father's sleeve. The example that I would use, I see this in shul all the time, pulling on a father's arm, you know, to leave. I've seen things in which a child has, like, hit a parent, you know, to go, you know, so to speak, done something, something totally inappropriate where the child has done something directly to the parents in an inappropriate manner. The parent now must respond. It's appropriate. This is not behavior that is acceptable. How do you respond? How do I let my child know it is absolutely unacceptable for you to yell at me this way? It's unacceptable for you to tug at me, to pull at me, to hit me. It's unacceptable. So the way that you do it is you talk about it from your perspective and your feelings. And you could speak harshly when you speak that. You could speak very strongly. That is okay as long as you are not attacking the child. You are describing yourself. I do not like being hit. I won't tolerate being hit. I don't like being yelled at. I won't be yelled at. But it's from my perspective of what I do or don't like, in which you don't leave the child with the opposite. What we generally do, or people generally do, is in which we talk about the child, and we describe the child's behavior as far as you're a pain in the neck, you always do this, you're that. So when you describe it from your perspective, it bothers me when you do that. I can't, I don't like it. That's a way to address an issue, yeah.
So let's use that example you're talking to somebody or whatever, or you're in the store and you're checking out, and the child decided that he wants to go,
right,
and he hits you. So you turn to him and you say, I don't like to be hit.
Correct.
So he hits you again.
Okay, so then, 100%. In other words, if we're in that mode, in other words, if that doesn't work.
He's like, because he's frustrated. Because he's now frustrated because I'm not listening to him, or I'm not leaving as fast as he wants me to, or they put away the toy that I bought him and he wanted to hold it, and I'm in the middle of a conversation with the cash register person, and this is his mode of getting my attention.
Excellent.
He hit me, I said I don't like to be hit, and he hits me.
Okay, so the first thing that I would do is, if you see that there's a reason why it's going on, in other words, if you could tell, would be together with your I don't like to be hit, go back to what we did last week, why is he hitting you? I know that you must be very frustrated because you want this, but I don't like to be hit. So that it's not like I'm acknowledging there's a reason why you're doing this. I acknowledge that, I recognize that, but this is not a way that you're going to be able to express yourself. If he does it again, which would be normal, then I would go back into love and logic. In other words, because I don't know, this is a form of communication. This whole approach is how I want you to speak to the child. Now, then it would be a matter of your classic child in the grocery store of, see, we have to go home, and you create a whole other time where you would otherwise go with him, and you can't go with him because you're not sure you're going to be able to take him somewhere because last time you took him, ended up getting hit, so I'm not sure. Whatever, you'd have to create a scenario where you otherwise would have gone to another store, and that child can't come because you're too afraid.
What do you do in the moment?
Okay, so in the moment?
In the moment, he's tugging on you, hitting you, you're trying to pay, you're having a discussion about an item rung up at the wrong price. You need to have this discussion. There's a whole line of people.
This is the nightmare scenario.
He's tugging at you and he's hitting you, but mom, but mom, but mom, but mom. Where do you go?
So,
I understand he's frustrated. Yeah. I understand there must be something he wants to tell me. He probably wants the M&Ms from behind the counter. Now's not the time. Sweetie, I understand you want to talk to me. I'll talk to you in a minute, but I don't like to be hit.
Right.
I'm in the middle of a conversation. You must wait until this conversation is done. I don't want to be hit. But, Mom, now what?
Are you asking me?
Yeah. I'm asking anyone. I don't care. Anyone
out here. Do you want to give a...
Not a dating issue, but we had an interrupting issue.
Yeah.
It was a natural. It wants attention. So what we did with our three-year-old is that I would just be talking to my wife, and she would just start talking to us. Mm-hmm. So I said, Tamima, if you want to talk to me and I'm talking to Emo, you say, excuse me. It got to a point where, like, if I was talking to her, she would just say, excuse me, like, in a way that would be rude for an adult to do.
Right.
But the first 20 or 50 times, whatever it was, we just said yes. You know, like, excuse me works, and then after that we touch each other. You know, there are times you can't, that doesn't even work. But so she has an outlet that we will respond to. And so, yeah, that may not work if there's an issue right now with the cash register, right? But like as a preparation that she knows she has an outlet to get my attention.
Okay, there's a permissible way.
But now, okay, so we've done the excuse me, I'm sorry, and we've done the excuse me, and so now he thinks that, okay, if he says excuse me, that's his entitlement to interrupt any conversation, regardless of who it's with or where we're at.
Right.
So, you know, because I'll say to him, sweet, this is not the way you're going to get my attention. You need to find a different way to communicate with me, or I don't respond to, I don't like to be yelled at. You're going to have to find a different way to talk to me. So now, very sweetly, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, and I'm still in the middle of something.
Excuse me, mommy.
Excuse me, mommy. Excuse me, mommy. Excuse me, mommy. Excuse me, mommy. I'm still in the middle of something that I can't necessarily say, oh, well, you asked so nicely. Now I can just devote all my attention to you.
So I want to respond to that before we get to the crisis issue of the store. There's a very important concept, which I know you guys were in that, discussed in the marriage workshop that I did based on John Gottman. He calls something what he calls bidding. Bidding is where one person makes an attempt for the attention of somebody else. In marriage, it would obviously be one spouse to another spouse, but he talks about it as far as children bidding for the attention of parents as well. It is critical to respond to the bid, using that terminology, of a child, even if the response is, no, I can't talk right now. So it's a good habit, even if you say, when you say, excuse me, so then you can stop your conversation and say, to actually respond to the child, right now I'm talking to mommy, I'll be with you in a few minutes. As opposed to, when you ignore it, then you get that, mommy, mommy, excuse me, mommy, excuse me, mommy, excuse me, mommy, and then kick your heels, excuse me, mommy, I've been saying 15 times, excuse me. Right? So it's important to, we often don't do that, we're like so caught up, but when a child does what we ask them to do, when they want to get our attention, but we can't stop because we're in the middle of something, and that's fair, but it is appropriate to acknowledge the child and say, thank you for saying excuse me. I'm in the middle of something. I will be with you in 2 minutes.
Excuse me, mommy.
In 2 minutes. And then she's
excuse me, mommy.
Right? So then...
And then do you get to ignore it?
I don't know that I would ignore it. I would think...
And you have to at that point, you have to shift the tactic. And
yeah.
You're just going to have to be patient and wait. Go stand over there until we're ready to talk. Something like that.
Yeah, or the extreme would be moving, bringing in like a fetch room kind of thing, like if it gets to that point, that's an extreme approach, but you'd have to, in other words, you have to acknowledge, and then you have to get back to the, in other words, if we get into the habit of actually getting back to the child, they'll build on those experiences also of when they ask appropriately, they get a response right away, and then we're good at going back. If we're bad at that, then we'll get that constant, excuse me, except that slot machine example. Like it has to be where we're actually, it's hard to do to remember to go back to the child and say, yes, what was it that you had wanted? We'll talk a lot more about that when we get to the, today, the sibling rivalry. It's that same where you're dealing with one child and the other child wants your attention, and you're now, I'm in the middle of this with this child, and then that child comes in, and how to handle that sort of same kind of way of acknowledging right away the other child. Yes, I know that you need something. Right now I'm working with this child, and when I finish here, I'll be happy to be with you. And remembering to get back. It's that same, but none of that's going to address your crisis situation in the supermarket, in the moment, where you have that child yelling and screaming. You know, this is where I would always go back to a love and logic kind of thing. And I was like, once the methods of communication, you're speaking correctly, you haven't put the child, all that, and it's not the child, it's not working, then I would always go back to something like that. So, you know, what would I do at that moment? If I could, and you can't always do this, I would literally leave everything there. This is, a purist would say, tell the cashier, I can't finish this right now, and somehow put things aside and literally go home with the child, and then everything would be dealt with. Now that usually doesn't work. That's why it's not practical. That's because it's not worth it for you to do that.
With that kind of example, I feel like the kid doesn't see. For us, it's we're dealing with
right.
The natural consequences. The kid is not. The kid wants to go home. The kid doesn't want to be in the grocery store. I mean, even
that's why it's really hard to come up with a way that it makes sense
right.
That the kid really feels the loss.
It's hard for them to feel it.
It's doable. It's doable in the sense that the next time you want to go somewhere fun, you can't because the last time I went out with you, it was I'm afraid of what I'm going to get. I don't like that approach. So I'm throwing it out there. You know, in the moment, the most important thing is not to lose your right. Not to lose. In other words, to let your child know that it is no sweat for you to handle him.
Is it a problem? Like, to me, it doesn't bother me if my kid's going to cry for 5 minutes while I'm checking out. Because I could maybe tune it out, and I'm not embarrassed what other people are going to think, because people know that kids cry in the store.
First of all, just on that comment, you know what other people are thinking? They're thinking, thank God that's not my kid.
Yeah.
That's all they're thinking. They're not thinking, what a horrible parent. They're not thinking that parent needs a workshop. They're just thinking, thank God it's not my child.
Especially
when you're
at a checkout. You're going to be at a store in 5 minutes. Just to, so, I mean, it doesn't always work. You get so emotionally.
No, but my point is that that's what I would do. But that's in direct conflict with acknowledge the child and knowing that he doesn't
acknowledge.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. So like, at what point? But if he's saying excuse me, and you're supposed to say, that's great. You're now saying it the way I want you to, but I can't get to you right now. So now he says excuse me again. Okay. Excuse me again. Excuse me again. That's what I asked. I said. So at that point, can you just ignore?
Maybe
and not respond to the child.
Maybe you give a choice. Would you like to hold my hand while I finish up and then I'll pay attention to you? Or would you like to come sit in the cart until it's over? And then you can say, excuse me, all you want to in the cart, but I acknowledged you.
Yeah, there's given options. That's the chronological way to do it. You give them options. Like, we had a kid who would sit down in the cart in the store. So I said, you need to go in the cart and sit down, or you can go in the car and I'll sit in the car with you. She kept crying. So I said, "Miss Anna, you know, I get to go in the store, but you know." So in this case, like you say, I can either wait for me to finish the conversation, and you know, we can get a nice treat or something, or we can keep this up and you know, maybe you know, we'll have time. Like that. Not the worst.
The bottom line, those crisis situations, you know, if you go through all the methods and the natural consequences is tough to come by, it's a tough situation. Often those situations, the crisis situations, could have been nipped in the bud a lot before. Something happens. You should, most children, if things are, you know, you usually, they don't erupt out of nowhere. If we're a little bit in tune, we see it coming. Or we know what their buttons are, or so there's a lot of times where there's a way where you could use some other method that would work before them. Just something to be aware of. It's not going to help you again if you get to that point and you're standing in the checkout line. I don't know. I don't have a great response for that.
Well, for us, usually when they go grocery shopping, they always know that they're going to get a special treat if they're going to the store.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wait to go to that aisle until the end, because if they're not being good, they're throwing a fit, they want to, in the cart. And then I go, I'm just going to go up to the floor and I'm here to say, oh, well,
do you want your treat? Because you're not passing another goodwill, you're not going to get your treat. So, no, I want my treat. Things are being better. So I get the checkout counter and they're being bad and they're crying because they want me to hold them, but I can't hold them and do this and that at the same time. I said, you're not going to be a good girl. Well, I'll have to stay the treat for next week because you're not going to be able to have it because they're not being a good girl. They have to be a good girl from start to finish. So if they're not good, then it's kind of like a bribery. So it's not really...
A little bit, yeah.
But I think I use bribery a lot. that way, it's like you get a treat when you're a good girl. If you're not being a good girl, you can't get it. So it's also kind of like natural consequence.
It's a little bit of a reward and punishment more than a natural consequence.
But you said more or less when you're talking about you can stop here, there, and there, and you can stop for a bakery and this
right.
and the other. So they're going to get something.
Right. No, that's the same. In other words, that's where, but it's different. In other words, I know part of Friday afternoon with Dad is you're going to get a special treat. Not because you've done anything. Part of the trip is... I love you. This is our time together on a Friday afternoon. I'm going to get you something while we're in the store.
That's how it is. I'm happy about
something. No, but if you present it as if you'll be a good girl, you'll get a treat, then it's a reward for my behavior as opposed to a consequence. I'm going to give them something, and then I'm just going to use that thing that I'm giving them, which is already, I've put that on the table already, that's not contingent upon anything. They decide how they want it. You want to stop, for ice cream? You want a bagel? You want a donut? You want the bakery? You want to go to Target? I'm going to respond to their 1,000 questions with, sure, if you want that, we'll do that. But it's already because I put it on the table as not being contingent upon anything.
We cash that in a rule sometimes, like good girls get treats. As a rule, therefore, it doesn't seem like a reward per se. And it's still the same thing,
if you end up
eating
the snack in the store while you're shopping,
it
keeps them quiet for a long time. That's
the idea.
Get a bag of
Bamba.
It lasts, hopefully.
It is worthwhile. I just wanted to stress that it's a fine line between reward and punishment and natural consequence. And to be aware, the more that you do it, if you ever get that sense, if it's not work, like children often don't respond. A lot of times the rewards, they just say they're not interested. And there's not much of a consequence. It's a balance, it's a line that you can cross between when it's a reward and punishment versus the natural consequence, and versus the example that I gave last week in which I'm just giving them something, totally upfront about it, no problem, I know that I'm giving them, it's not contingent upon anything, and then whether or not how that will manifest itself they have the ability to determine that as we go along. Okay, there are a couple others here. I'm going to leave them. There's a write-in notes, which for most of your children is already, for older children, good for your spouse, but you could. Your kids aren't really old enough for that so much.
No, I'm not even old enough.
Not because they don't read, because the writing a note, what it accomplishes is when you're very you're frustrated, emotional, it's a way of communicating in a way that takes away a lot of the tone. Mm-hmm. And you could write it in a much less, even at night.
He just kept on doing whatever.
Yeah, I would be surprised. I wasn't gonna get to it, but it happens on the same page as some of the examples about talking about your feelings. So,
it's not working.
As your kids get older, maybe. But I haven't found that personally successful. Okay, next little section: encouraging autonomy. Now, here are some great, great tools. I love some of these. Okay, the first one, give choices, we've spoken about a lot. Let's move past that one. Respect for a child's struggle, page 6. This is so important. We do this so often. You'll watch parents will hover over their children, and each time their child struggles with a task, the parent jumps right in and says, oh, here, let me do this for you. Let me show you how that's done. One of the important and classic growing moments in a child's life is as they struggle with those things. Let the child do it. An example here on page 6 of, child tries opening up a jar of cookies, whatever it may be. So instead of jumping in and right away saying, oh, here, let me do that for you, let the child do it. Respect the struggle. Oh, it's so hard to open up these jars. Give him advice. Try doing this. Try doing that. Hold it like that. It is a... We sometimes train our children, and as soon as they run into a little bit of trouble, the first thing that they do is they hand it back to the parents and they say, here, you do it. And they never break that habit because they had parents who hovered over them, And every task that they couldn't do, stepped in and did it. And one of the great things we can allow our children to do is struggle with that. I remember having it with my Shlomo recently. He sometimes doesn't finish his breakfast. So he knows that, oh, we're leaving at a certain time, and if you don't finish, it's going in a Ziploc, and off to school we go. So now we've got his little chores in a Ziploc. And I get right at the door, we get to the parking lot, the carpool parking lot, the door's open, ready to push him out, and he wants to close the Ziploc bag. Now, for an adult, that's a one that they have stuck in activity. It's made to be real easy, but he was going to do it. Now, for a four-year-old, he wasn't even four at the time, the fine motor skills required to snap up the whole thing is not a two-second task. And he had set his mind that he was going to do it. He was sitting there, the door's open, and Rebecca's right outside, and she, of course, being a preschool director, is totally okay with letting him do this. I have to go somewhere. And he's standing at the door of the car, you know, it's like, can't we just, like, move him out and let him do it? But he was like, you know, four-year-olds, when they get into their world, and it's a matter of not grabbing it and doing it and handing it back to him. Letting him take the extra 30 seconds and learn how to do that. Giving them the task, let them figure out how to bustle themselves. And there are lots of examples where that happens, and you know, these are two little examples that they have over here, but allow the child to struggle and respect the difficulty that the child has in how hard it is to do it. If making a tie for the first time is hard, it takes a long time.
The question is, this with plus siblings, is that when siblings get in fights, for instance,
yeah.
Is there always one is to say, let me step in, make it sure to resolve the issue, but then more is for yourself, you know, when you're screaming,
right.
Or just let them fight it out, but then someone gets hurt, or, you know, look, this would say kind of just let them work it out and try to figure it out.
Yeah, they should. Now, we're definitely not going to get to today because I'm interested to know that there's an entire book, Siblings Without Rivalry, that they wrote on that aspect. So we're for sure not going to get to it today. That I see for sure. But yeah, generally be to let them work it out. Let them work it out in a way in which there's like supervision in terms of which they're looking at fighting over something in terms of going in there and describing the problem. I see two children fighting over the same thing. You want it. Why don't you guys figure it out? Like, sometimes you could take the object and say, when you guys figure this out, I'll be happy to get it. But I can't take the screaming. You got. There's a lot of that, letting them work it out. For sure.
Say, you do this and you do that.
100%, yeah. 100%. Because then both children feel they were forced into something. And it's the best thing is to say, describe the problem. I see this as your toy. You had it first. You want it back. Two children, one toy. I don't know. When you guys figure this out, let me know. And totally hand it off to them. This is not just siblings. This is everyday Shabbos, where you have of two friends that are fighting over the same toy. And not to impose. You need to sort of direct, give them the direction. You guys figure this out. Let me know. I'll be happy to, you know, hand it back to you guys.
That's kind of hard to do with, like, a two-year-old and a three-year-old, I feel like. The younger one gets a lot of times arrive from the field. But sometimes I would do, I don't know if this is something, if you're fighting over something, I think this needs to go into timeout. Because you guys can't play with this. Like, you're just fighting over it, so if I just take away what they're fighting, it doesn't necessarily solve. It just, the idea
you, that you would be surprised at a 2 and 3 year old if you did that. If you said, now you two are speaking at all?
Yes.
If you would say, Mom's going to hold on to this when you guys figure this out. You'd be surprised how quickly your 3-year-old will figure out a very simple thing of, how about I play for it first, and then I'll give it to you. Now, the 3-year-old's always going to go that route, which is fine. The 2-year-old will agree, but they've actually solved the problem. Yeah. And as they get older, you'll see that'll either switch, because now there'll actually be two parties negotiating, and the younger won't be so fast to say, okay, fine, you can have it first. But your 3-year-old, you'll see, I'll be happy to you come and work with them, very quickly will say something along those lines. They'll get the better end of the deal, but they'll come up with a deal, and they'll get their younger siblings to agree to it, and the problem is solved. They'll play with it, and then you just have to administer the deal, make sure that she gives it up. And on their level, they've actually worked it out. and the screaming has stopped, and you've handed the prop to them. I think even at 3 and 2, you probably can give it a shot. I'm going to go to the bottom of page 7. Another critical thing which I have enjoyed in my own home, what an impact this has had. Children ask questions. They are full of questions. They ask questions about every single thing that they see. One of the best things that we can do is not answer their question. It's very tempting. We want to give them answers. Very often, first of all, they're not interested in our answers. Very often our answers are way above their heads as far as, you know, however, kid asks, like, where does rain come from? You try explaining to a 4-year-old where rain comes from. Like, good luck. You're going to go, where are you going to go with that one? So you're going to start, and within 10 seconds, the kid's eyeballs are in the back of their head, and, you know, the discussion's over. Just give it back a great question. What do you think? And they will come up with the most fascinating, interesting responses. I mean, I've had some of my kids have asked about, you know, Neshama, Hashem, and excellent, I don't know, what do you, and they have theories and ideas, and then you have a, like you were saying, a conversation about things that you never would have known where they're holding, and on their level you can redirect a little bit, some of it you don't have to. You know, like in a child who's sucking their thumb, and they're getting older. You know, they're not going to walk down the aisle sucking their thumb. They're going to outgrow certain behaviors. So if a child has a belief about what their neshama looks like at 4, I'm really not concerned if their understanding of the neshama is way off. It doesn't really bother me. So let's have a conversation. That's great. We'll talk about it. Maybe I'll get a little bit more through the conversation than we had before. But I'm not going to sit here and explain to my 4-year-old who says, what happens in a cemetery? Or what does it mean to bury someone? Because they'll hear us talking. Great question. I don't know. So there's a certain freedom as a parent. We don't have to have all the answers. In fact, not only do I not need to have all the answers, but I'm actually going to throw that back. Ah, great question. What do you think? Very rarely does a child say, I don't know. That's what teenagers do that. But if we're still dealing with like younger kids, they actually have thoughts. They have things to say. So get used to letting them figure that out, have that conversation. And if following that up with what goes on then on page 8, to encourage them to use sources outside of the house, this is especially important from a Torah perspective. Children ask halachic questions, something related to Judaism. Great question. Let's ask Rabbi so-and-so the next time we see him. I do this with my kids all the time. I just played up with Rabbi Feldman, or with another Rebbe of mine, and even though they have, you know, their dad's the rabbi, I love it not answering their question and saying, that's an awesome question. Let's ask so-and-so the next time we see him. To teach them, first of all, they're not even going there, they're just saying it's good to encourage children to learn how to use outside resources. Encourage them to learn how to use the library, encourage them to use how to ask others. But even just from a perspective, when they ask questions, and it's in a question within Yiddishkeit, it's a Jewish question, it's, even if you happen to know the answer, it's a great opportunity to say, first of all, what do you think? And then say, that's a good, next time, let's ask. And I guarantee any rabbi you know, you ask, will be very well equipped to respond to the child in the same way, like, excellent question. Sometimes they'll have an answer, but they don't have an answer. I don't have answers for that, because even when a kid asks me, if someone else's 4-year-old asks me what happens in a cemetery, I'm just as ill-equipped to answer that 4-year-old's question about the neshama and the ghost as I am to answer my 4-year-old's question. But just having the dialogue is what's valuable, and willing to respond. I want to add something that Chaim Ginat, writing one of his books, which is the other, he's the Rebbe of Faber Mezlish, he tells a story of a 6-year-old who asked his father how many abandoned children there are in the particular city that they lived in. So his father was a lawyer, was very excited that his son had taken an interest in social issues and social justice, he said, great question. He looks up and then he says to his child, you know, there are 400 abandoned children in this particular city. How many abandoned children are there in the state? How many abandoned children are there in the country? How many abandoned children are there in the world? And after 4 or 5 questions, the father finally realized the child was not interested in the answer as to the number of abandoned children that there are. What was the child really interested in? More than that.
He's talking to his dad.
He was afraid of being abandoned. He had just heard someone speaking. Children pick up on all the stuff that goes on in the house. Someone had been speaking about an abandoned child. And also the child, how many abandoned children are there in the city, in the state, in the country, in the world? He has no interest as a six-year-old child. 400, 600, 700, 2,000. The numbers are meaningless. He's saying to his father in a coded question, as children often ask, what does it mean to be abandoned, and is that going to happen to me? So there's a certain, often you get these questions also, when children ask, what happens in a cemetery? What happens in the Neshama? There's often a question underneath that when you respond and say, good question, what do you think, will either bring it out, and to be aware of, listen to the questions that your children ask. Hear the layers underneath it as to what really might be going on behind that question. There is some concern. Very often a child, when they ask a question like that, how many abandoned children are there? There's something else going on, and being sensitive to what that is and paying attention, that hearing the question for what it really is also a great skill. Okay, I'm moving too fast. We're just plowing through. Okay, let's do the third section. Freeing children from playing roles. So this is an issue that we often have. We define our children, we pigeonhole them into certain roles, and then they get stuck and we get stuck in that role. So, oh, I'm sorry, I did, thank you. I actually had a nice example of that today, that's just from today. Thank you. Don't take away help. So this often happens, some of the examples, right? I'm trying out the leaf part, and the mother says, you know, you're never going to be able to get it. It's really a tough thing. You're up against a lot of competition. Like, what happens when we regularly do that, you know, I want to get big. Oh, you're too young. No one's going to hire you. We just train the children when they have these hopes and aspirations, and we just pound them down. Well, what do you do as a parent when a child expresses something and you happen to know they're not going to get it? The reality is, you know he's not going to get the leaf part. You know that she's too young for a babysitting job. So you don't need to take away hope for that. So we're playing catch outside today, taking advantage of the day off. So this is a much less offensive example than some of those other things about a child trying to get a part. So the ball got past one of us, so he's now standing three times the distance from where we normally are throwing it. So he says, do you think I can reach you from here? I get a question just like that. In which, again, I've just been working on this earlier that day. So instead of saying,
Probably not,
or no, for sure not, why don't you come closer? I said, I don't know. Why don't you give it a shot? It's such a small nuance. It's such a small little difference in your everyday interactions with your children. But it makes such a world of difference when you put it in a bigger picture and there's a constant approach where, do you think I can make it from here? I don't know. Let's give it a shot. As opposed to, no, of course not. Come in. You can't reach me. It's so small. It really is.
There's a fear. I think that it comes from wanting to protect your child. You don't want him. You're trying to save him from future disappointment.
Can you?
Potentially.
Do you really believe that you can save your child from future disappointment?
I don't know.
I'll tell you. The answer is no. You really can't. I mean, in a healthy way, just like your parents could not have prepared you for possible disappointments. The only way we live life is we put ourselves out and we try. And the best thing you can do for your child is equip them to deal with the disappointments of life.
But in the situation that you just said, I almost feel like you're being deceitful, but you're not giving him an honest answer to the question. The question is, do you think that I can make it here?
The answer is no, I don't think that you can make it.
I would say,
I think this is really what I said, or what I should have said, this is pretty far. You want to give it a shot? And you're right, he'll be disappointed, and then the response is, that was pretty far. That was a pretty far throw from where you are. Maybe next month you'll be a little bit closer. You cannot protect your child from the disappointments of life. You can't. You can hover over him from the time he's 4 until he's 24. You still can't protect him, and you won't be hovering over him. So it's much more valuable to get into a habit of a language of dealing with disappointment. How do you then handle that? rather, and in other words, let's pick up what we started from in the morning. Let's say that's totally unnatural for you. Now, right, we're just playing a little game of catch. I'm dealing with a 6-year-old, 7-year-old, and, you know, he's not able to throw that far, and he has, oh. And I get into the habit of learning to respond. That was a pretty far throw. I bet next year you'll be able to throw it even farther. But something, a small little dialogue, really nothing. But I didn't have that shooting him down right from the beginning. I remember there's a woman here in the community who had attempted, was trying to get into, already been married for 10, 15 years and wanted to go back to school for some major program. And a series of events took place. She needed to do a bunch of prerequisites just to be able to get into the program. It took an entire year of the prereqs. And she needed to get a certain grade on a certain thing. And a bunch of events had taken place, and because she had a family, and then the teachers weren't forgiving. And bottom line is, she didn't make it. She didn't even qualify to get into it. Like, a whole year was almost wasted. Now she had to wait a whole nother. And I remember her husband telling me, and I had to respond. Like, it was a massive disappointment. The public, everybody knew this is what she was working towards. And then everybody knew, because it didn't work out, she had to wait a whole nother year. How do you handle this disappointment? There's no way to protect this now grown woman from this. How do you handle that? And I remember, I wouldn't know what to say. So her husband told me that her father called and had left a message on the machine saying something was already, a couple years back, but I don't think something was, we're so proud of how hard you tried. We believe in you, and we're sure that next year you'll be able to, you know, you'll get it. It was some message of hope, in acknowledging how disappointing it was. We're so proud of the efforts that you put in, and you know, next year, God willing, you'll be able to get. To be able to do that as a parent when your child's 35 really takes a lot of practice from when your child is 6 and the stakes are really low and the disappointment is really low, but that there is, yeah, I'll let you try. You're going to put yourself out there, and a lot of times you're going to fail, but I'm going to learn the dialogue of how to be there when you're disappointed, to acknowledge your disappointments, and give you the encouragement that you need to move forward. So, and so it might be, I don't think it's misleading to tell him to give it a shot, you know, to throw the ball from where he can, but it's, as opposed to saying, no, you can't come in, it looks pretty far to me, but if you want to give it a shot, go ahead.
And I also think that the child knows themselves that he probably
can't do it.
To, but because you believe in him, he's willing to give it a shot.
Right. Also. The end of the day, yes.
Even like with the babysitting, like the child deep down probably, most kids know what they could do and what they can't do.
100%. And there's an attitude that we want to instill within our children of, I am going to try, and I'm going to learn to deal with the disappointment, as opposed to, and you see this in children who have been brought up with, I don't think I can do it. I don't think I can do it. I'm not willing to try. I don't think I can do it. That comes from, not only, I don't ever want to say anything I would like put all the blame on, but it comes from whenever, you know, they would have had that opportunity, either they learned or they were told, no, you can't do it. You can't do it. Give them the chance. Encourage them. And then what we're about to do, which was the next thing was give them opportunities to succeed. Right, that was moving into this next thing, is freeing children from playing roles. See if we could get through this before we hit 9:30. Okay, so this has a lot of different aspects to it. So the way that these cartoons are done a little bit differently, with the little X's, are the words are the trait that you've already established that your child has shown, and you're now going to get rid of those particular traits. So for example, look for opportunities to show the child a new picture of himself or herself. You have a child who regularly sees themselves in a certain way. Now, this goes without saying, if you have put the child in that position, you have said too many times, you can't do this, you have two left thumbs, you're not responsive. Let's say the child himself has begun to see themselves, and then as your children get older, you will find they'll come home more often saying, I can't do this, I'm not a good artist, I'm not a good sports player, I'm not a good this. Find, it's our role as a parent to find the opportunities where they display the trait, the opposite of what it is that they believe in themselves, and to point it out to them. It is, this. I spoke about mitzvah notes in a couple of different contexts. I don't remember where they were. This is a repetition for you, maybe, I don't know. I used to hate mitzvah notes. I thought they were like the worst thing in the world, because they were so tedious on me as a parent to have to find something to say every morning, like what they did. And I've come to see there's a tremendous value in being forced to look for things your children are doing. Look for them, be aware of them, find them, and call them out on it. We're real good at calling out our children on the mistakes they make. We're excellent at that. Right away, it doesn't take any training, no parenting workshop in the world. Right away, we're on. We point it out. You did this wrong, that wrong. Mitzvotes are an opportunity to get into the habit of paying attention, of finding the things that they do, and then noting it, telling the children about it. Let them see themselves in a different light. Right? You have this is the first little one. You've had that toy for 3 months, almost 3 years, and it looks like new. Who would think of saying something like that unless you were looking for an opportunity with a child who often breaks things? If you're looking for it, you'll find, wow, you still have that toy. That's so amazing that it's been around for so long, and nothing has happened to it. And most of these examples are for a little bit older children, but it applies just in the same way for younger children, which fits right on the right-hand side of the page. Then, a science for finding your children when they do that and catching them, give them the opportunities to do it. So often we are so guilty as parents, in which we know that we have a particular child who's not very good at something, so we purposely don't give them the opportunities to do those things. We direct them to other children, and we do them for ourselves. It's not our role as parents. So find the right scale to have the child do it, and purposely give them the task that they have, so to speak, at this point, not been good at, not been successful at. Give them the task. You know, the child who's not good with tools, or not good with their hands, or a greedy child. Give that child the jelly beans and say, here, there are four of us at the table, here are 8 jelly beans, you be in charge of dividing it up evenly, and let the child be responsible for giving it out. And then you can say, wow, that was such a good job, you had that, where you were able to share. Put the child in the position where they're able to succeed and redefine themselves, look at themselves in a light that they had otherwise not necessarily been looking at themselves. Moving on to, there's no page number, but on the let children over here, you say something positive about them. I want to go back to the thing that I said about Shlomo getting into his pajamas. I didn't do this because of this cartoon, but I hopped after it happened, and that's really what happened. I specifically didn't say it to Shlomo. Wow, I see, you got out of the bed. I said, he walked into the kitchen, and I said, Mommy, look at Shlomo. He, and I was talking about him to Rivki. There's something so rewarding about that as a child, as adults, we love that. But as a child especially, to hear one parent speaking to the other parent about that child, make it a habit when you catch something. Mothers for sure, when fathers come home from work or whatever, if it's in the opposite where a father's out with the child, come home, and let's say you go out shopping and the child was so good at the store. So don't just say in the car ride home, like, you know, you can knock off two birds with one stone. Instead of just praising the child, wow, you did such a good job, you were so patient, and you were so this, and so then you just go home and say to your husband, and say, about your child, where the child can clearly hear, you will see on the child's face what an impact it has. Yeah.
I was just making me think about, there are times when Tuma does something really good, and Tuma, tell Abba what you did today. And so thinking that she'll be so excited because she was so proud to make a whole big deal when she did it, she goes, no, I want you to tell him. So I wonder if it's because she wants to hear it or just because she's too shy to tell him.
I think there's something so rewarding about one parent sharing. Well, again, when the type of praise and feedback is descriptive, so it's not saying this child is amazing and wonderful, which causes all those uncomfortable feelings of, but I know that I'm not here. Accurately if describing what the child did, it is so rewarding as a child to hear one parent being honestly excited about it. Just changes their perception of who they are. You're defining for them what they can be simply by describing what they did. Not giving them a false sense of who they are, they're so amazing, they're so awesome, they're so helpful. Saying, not that you were so helpful, this is how you were helpful today. I needed this and you did X, Y, and Z, and you're telling it over in an excited manner to your husband. It's amazing for a child. It really is. And it's that a wonderful tool. Modeling the behavior you'd like to see. This is something where, especially when you want, you know that there'll be, I brought an example, love and logic, like here you have a sore loser. Your child, you don't like playing games, child's a sore loser. So love and logic is where you specifically beat your child. Child goes on to his usual sore losing approach, and then you basically say, well, I'm not interested in playing with a sore loser, and then you don't play for a little bit, which is an approach of, well, teach him when the stakes are low, just with you, because you're eventually on him. So the other, another approach would be to specifically lose and then model your experience. Oh, I so badly wanted to beat you and I hate losing, it's so hurtful. But, and this is how, you know, and just model it. And that helping out in the kitchen is, you know, who's going to help me put away the dishes? I'm always the first one to jump up and do that. When, you know, Rifki will say, I need help with this. I'm always the first one. I should say always because I'm probably not. I try to be the first one to jump up and say, I'll do it. And then it creates a culture in the home of, well, that's what we do. They see this is how daddy acts. That becomes absolutely normal. If dad sits on the couch reading a book and mom asks for help, it's really hard to then get angry at the kids when the kids do the same thing. We'll talk later. Yeah, well, all this stuff applies equally. Okay, one more thing we'll do and then we'll just wrap up. One more thing is be a storehouse for your child's special moments. This is really, really also very, very important. Really, really, very, very. We are the storehouse of our children's experiences, their memories, what they've done and what they've accomplished. They will come home and say, I'm no good. I'm a bad artist. I'm a bad player. I'm a bad actor. Whatever. They will come home and say it. What is our response? So, without any workshop, we would say, oh, no, you're not. You're so good. And they're thinking, right? Unhelpful. So, whatever, whether or not they're old enough to express what Marcy was about to express or not, that doesn't help them. No, you're not. Right? That's going, right? They're coming in, they're clearly, something happened, either because someone said something to them and it didn't really happen, or because they really failed at something. And they're now coming in saying, I am no good. I guarantee if your children have not yet done this, they will. It is the standard, absolute, normal part of being a child that they're going to come home and say that they're no good. It is our role not to deny that feeling. They clearly have it from somewhere. To be able to prove to them that it's not true. And the only way that we can do that is by bringing examples, real life examples, where they have displayed behaviors contrary to whatever it was that was said to them. So one approach is this being that storehouse. Someone said, I'm not an artist. So now maybe they're not an artist. Right? So there are really a couple different approaches. If it's really true, they're not whatever it is that they're saying that they're not. So then you're not going to be a storehouse for their experiences because they don't have any or because all their experiences were poor. Let's assume it's not true, for example, like in this particular case. That's the easier one to deal with. So I'm uncoordinated. So the mother can say, well, how about all these things that you've done that have shown not that remember the time that you did this, remember the time that you did that. This is a task and a role of a parent to be able to come up with those kinds of things. If you don't have any at the tip of your tongue or there just aren't to draw on, that's always where the other approach that they discuss in these books would be, someone's so sad that I can't do this. And you say, oh, I don't really think about that about you. You know, what do you think that about yourself? Kind of thing. And why? Sort of engaging, getting into their mindset. You know, this happens all the time with siblings. So also calls me stupid. That's like my favorite, right? They come in. Oh, you're always stupid. Say, oh, that's funny. I don't think you're stupid. Do you think you're stupid? And they'll either say, no. I'll say, well, then that's an easy one. Conversation's over. And well, good. Well, I don't think you're stupid. And you don't think you're stupid. Who cares about what? What do you think? Then we'll run back into the playroom. So let's say they say, yes. And someone will call me stupid. That's funny. I don't think that you're stupid. Do you think you're stupid? And say, yes, I think you're stupid. And you can get, really? Why do you think you're stupid? And then they'll say, because I, you know, broke whatever. Whatever it was that caused the first child to call them. And then you need to be there with, boy, that's silly, because I remember when I needed someone to help me figure out what 5 plus 4 was, and you were right there with the answer for me, depending on whatever age a child is, engaging that and being able to be that storehouse of, boy, that's silly, I don't think you're an idiot. And, you know, because they're going to come to you with, so-and-so, that's going to happen. And it's a matter of being able, in their world, where they're feeling sort of shaky about it, because someone said it, and we all know that children, when someone else calls them that, they're going to think that that's real, being able to show that, well, I don't know, that doesn't seem real to me, and being able to prove to them from things that they've actually done why it's not true. Sometimes if you can't just, you're saying that, I don't think that, it's sometimes almost enough. In terms of that, the worst thing you do is like, yeah, I'll get that. You know, you pick up and you leave the child and you go yell at the other brother. There's no need to do that. It's just a matter of, boy, I don't think you're stupid. I would ignore it. And so, it's very often that's like literally all it takes as far as that scenario goes. All right. I'll leave you with the thing. Go over the cartoons. I think they're wonderful. All the books, the reading list, had a talk with your parent and child. If you're interested, maybe send an email. We could do a whole thing on Sibling Rivalry. There's like a whole book on that. And we haven't immediately get to a couple of examples we touched on, but that's a whole another book. I hope this was helpful. I have, as you got for all the examples that I've been bringing, it's just in the last couple of weeks, just as I'm holding in this, I just see it everywhere. The examples are everywhere. Parenting is one of those things where you're never like done working on it. Because as the children grow and get older, the examples get different, and each child is different, and so the review is great. So review the stuff, read. I'm happy to, you know, do whatever is necessary. But I hope it was. I will send that something. I'm going to show you as far as feedback goes, whether or not this worked with the two methods, the love and logic versus this, how they played off each other. I personally am a big believer in it, as I've just been saying over and over again. Different situations call for different things. The more you get comfortable with both of them, the more you'll naturally just slip right into whatever it is. But the way that we speak to our child is so key, and then the way that we respond to them. And that's basically that. Comments, questions, or that's basically it. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'd like to just say,
yeah,
the last month has been incredible for us, and I think it's really made a quantum difference in our relationship with our kids, and just shallow bias, really.
And with each other.
And with each other. And having a consistent approach that, because before this, we kind of had our own methods, and very often they didn't work together, and there was a lot of contention and source of friction between us, how we were handling a certain situation. And now we have a unified approach that we both agree upon. It's been fantastic.
Excellent. All right.
You have the opposite.
I think it works. This isn't working. About we have different methods, different ways. Like this way better, not this way better.
I'm hoping at that situation it would be good to use this one method, and I think the other way, and end up causing actually more rift.
So the marriage will
be good.
Right.
You're like turning to your husband and saying,
instead of,
came in at this moment and the kids playing you off of each other, because the kids now know daddy's coming home. They know about when he's coming home. The kids know daddy's coming home. And the kids are also reacting. They react. It's taken me a while to figure out that it's not about what I'm doing wrong or what he's doing right or anything like that. It's that kids are going to react to the different parents in different ways. And so daddy coming home and saying something that you've been saying 14 times that they're not responding to doesn't mean that you're doing it wrong, and it doesn't mean that you have to defend yourself to him.
Right.
It doesn't mean that you have to defend yourself to him. And I actually have gotten past caring whether he thinks that I've been doing a good or bad job, because that was part of the problem, was that I was really, like, now I'm just confident in the fact that, like, I'm doing it the way that I'm doing it. Most of the time now, I'm doing it in an approach that he would like. If it's not working or he comes in the middle of it and thinks that I've either not done it right or whatever, he has no idea what was going on before he walked into the situation. And I don't really care what he thinks. And if he wants to come in, and him coming in, sometimes kids just need a change. And if him coming into the situation and changing it up gets it better, more power to him. They're all yours.
Yes, right. Especially that I try to present the two different approaches. So as I set myself the examples I gave tonight, in which I didn't want to love and logic it. I didn't have the strength for it. So very often, as a mother home for like a 4-hour stretch with the kids, if you love and logic everything, you'd be a tank. And like the mental energy required to deal with coming up with valid natural consequences is tough. So you need to keep your own sanity, you need to get through the day. As a husband coming home and just dealing with literally dinner, bath, bed, those are pure love, those are great love and logic moments. It's easy. It's not the 5 o'clock in between playtime, outside, inside. It's actual tasks. We gotta feed the kids, we gotta bathe the kids, we gotta get them into bed. All of those are so much easier. Especially, like, he's like a love and logic kind of guy. He's liking the consequence. Those tasks are perfect. You got to deal with them from 1 to 6, which is a lot longer time, and it has all these activities that don't. I have to communicate more with my kids more than get them to do things.
Right. And you have to go to the store, and you have to get dinner made, and
It makes a lot of sense if you have that, where you'd be less hesitant to use a love and logic approach because you're dealing with them in a very different way than when there's a task to be done. So it's fine if you play off each other that way. And to me, it doesn't bother me at all, as far as, you know, as long as you're not feeling uncomfortable that they're, like, stretching and crying at 6:30, which most kids are, and you've had them for 4 hours, and it's like it's not an easy thing. But, you know, those are all part of it. As a lot of marketing law, the kids respond differently to the different parents, and especially in the example you're giving. Don't underestimate how different it is when you just need to entertain them for 3 hours and when you need to do tasks, bed, bath, dinner. They're very different parts of the day.
But a big thing is for me that I don't, is to stop feeling like I needed to either defend myself and or explain myself that, like, you know, I really have this under control, and to not take it as him walking into a situation where I spent the first couple years of our marriage. I mean, Darren has 3 very younger siblings that he sort of helped raise. And so there was always a part of me that felt like he knows how to do this better than I do. Because, you know, and I have my in-laws telling me, like, no, you're the mother. The mother has a better instinct than anybody. But I always felt like I was somehow inferior in my parenting skills and that I have to defend the way I was parenting or how I was doing things. And I'm now like 90%, I still have like 10% where I'm like, you know, where I feel like I need to defend myself to my husband about the way I'm doing something, but I'm over that. Like,
if that's like the opposite. I mean, I sometimes feel like I'm better at it.
Right.
Because I'm the mother and I've been around kids so much
before. But it's not about the parenting skill or how you're parenting. It's about how you're interacting with your husband and whether or not you feel it necessary to defend yourself to him when he comes in and gets the situation under control and he's walking around with this superior grin on, like, you know,
I don't understand what the problem is.
I'm just saying.
And, like, I have to learn just to be like...
Just to be confident in what you've done.
Yeah. I say, just, you know, it's the physician's fixed. It's a good thing.
Right.
You know,
instead
I'm going to help you now.
I get it.
I'm going to help you.
Instead of
just remember that if you have a case for 4 hours, you don't even want to walk into the house.
No, I don't.
Like, men are good at tasks. Come home at 6:30, there's a checklist. Dinner, bath, bed. We're good at that. And we don't always forget there's a natural tendency that, you know, men are more disciplinarian by nature. Like the Torah says, like, kibud av v'em, and like the children revere their father more and honor their mother more, because they know that's natural. So it just works out well that the men come home and the tasks need to be done and there are consequences for the task and a little bit of a harsher approach. It's fine that it works out that way. You can play off each other totally that way. It can almost be like where you can get to the point that, like, listen, girls, dad's going to be home in another 20 minutes then.
We all know what happens then.
That's fine. That buys you another 20 minutes of sanity. You know, that's great.
I want to clarify. Because what you're saying is the same as, like, it's not that, I mean, I think it was more my own self-image of thinking that he comes in, gets a situation, and that he feels superior about it. That's the way I perceive it, but I don't think at all that that's the way he was handling it. I think he was handling it like he handled it. It's done. Like, this is good.
Right,
this is good. But for me, I was being defensive because I felt like it was a weakness in
on
me.
You. Right.
And I had to get over that and just move to we're a team, and this means that this is good because the problem is solved. Anyway.
I think that's men and women.
Okay.
Right.
All right, excellent. All right, so I'll send an email about the Sylvan Robber if anyone's interested. We could do a whole nother...
Yeah.